this is Kevin Doherty, your host for Just Thinking. I'm also the chief marketing officer for NeuroPoints. We are a startup. We just started a little over a month ago, and I recently came off of the Learning Forward Texas conference. It was just a tremendous conference. Been a part of that group for 25 years and got to see many friends and introduce them to this new concept of NeuroPoints. And my guest today and I have been friends for about that long as well, and we'll be talking a little bit more about NeuroPoints toward the end of this conversation. But before I go any further, I'd like to have her introduce herself to you. So Dawn, tell us who you are and a little bit about what you do.
My name is Dawn Bailey, and I am currently a retired educator slash professor. I'm still working in the field with resident teachers, but I've been in education for about 33 years, from a teacher to a gifted specialist to a coordinator, principal. I think I've worn almost every hat you could wear. And Kevin and I, we met about 24 years ago, actually this month, talking about thinking. And so it's very appropriate that we've come back again, kind of our paths have crossed again on that same topic, because that has been a passion of mine. I have a master's in gifted education and educational leadership, and I'm currently working on a dissertation that I hope to finish in December. But it's always been focused on empowering teachers and empowering students and how we think and explore the world.
Well, Dawn, that's a perfect segue. And I know it's been 24 years since we first met, but neither of us have aged a bit since then, right?
No, not at all.
We look exactly the same. It's a fascinating, a little Benjamin Button thing maybe even going on here. But I tell you what, you just gave a great segue with the empowering teachers and learners. And so I'd like to ask you to speak a little bit more about empowering teachers and learners to do the rigorous work and to address the increasing demands of the work in school and beyond school today.
That's a great segue also, because we've been talking about 21st century learning, and now we're here in the 21st century. And with so much knowledge available, so much information available at our fingertips, and it's just coming at faster and faster rates, it's more and more important that we teach our students how to think at high levels, how to think critically, how to analyze information and evaluate it, and then more importantly, how to synthesize that information so that they're creating solutions to problems that affect their lives, that affect their communities and the world around us. Because as fast as we're changing, new issues are popping up all the time. And so one of the things I've always tried to impart on my teachers when I do professional development is it's not necessarily about the specific content that we're teaching, but it's about what are we doing with that content? How are we processing that content so that it's relevant to our students' lives? It's engaging and meaningful, but it also helps them to kind of establish their own patterns of thinking.
I love that. I love that. And so so taking that further, so they're gathering all this information, and so they're building knowledge, but then they're taking that knowledge and they're transferring it, they're applying it. So talk a little bit more about your beliefs and your experiences around this idea of building and transferring knowledge.
Mm-hmm. So I have an example. I brought an apple, there we go, on the camera. Everybody knows what this is. Kindergartners know what this is. And very often we teach about apples very young in kindergarten. We learn about the parts of the apple, where it grows, how it grows. We read stories. We might even do tastings of apples. But at the end of the day, it's not about the apple. And that's what I hope that teachers will understand as we work toward empowering thinking, is that the apple is just one vehicle. It's just one way that we can help students be exposed to thinking processes. So instead of just thinking about it as an apple, we could be thinking about it as, you know, what do things need to live and grow? So we could talk about plants. We could talk about animals. We could talk about sorting. You know, how many different ways could we sort different apples? How do we know it's an apple? How can we prove that it's an apple? Then we're starting to talk about characteristics and the way that scientists think. We could take it up to several grade levels higher, and we can look at the apple again and talk about in fifth grade, as an example, when they're doing fables and tall tales, we could be looking at giant apple seed, and we could be talking about from the tree to the table, fact to fable. How does the facts of the past affect the stories we tell now and in the future. So where does perspective fit in with that? How did the legend of Johnny Appleseed even exist? What's true? What's not true? Then that thinking can be applied to current events, and we can continue that process all the way up to high school and beyond as we're thinking about apples as symbolism in literature. There's a bunch of phrases about apples. An apple a day keeps the doctor away. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. You know, one bad apple spoils the bunch. So now we're talking about symbolism and comparing and contrasting. And so again, going back to the question of transfer, the apple is just the starting point. It's the entry point for us. But when we're starting to think about sequencing and comparing and contrasting and change over time, and multiple perspectives, all of those patterns are part of what we do as thinkers anyway. So we're going to now apply those not only to the apple, but how does that apply to my life? How do I change? What do I value? What are my values based on my past experiences? Because that influences how I see things. Then we're developing empathy on top of that.
That's so powerful. So speaking of the apple again, there's a lot of layers here, right?
Yes, exactly.
So Don, you and I have talked through the years about technology as a tool, but you've added to that technology as a tool and thinking is the fuel.
Yes. So I use AI in my work. We know students are using AI in their work. We know that our teachers are figuring out how to use AI in their work. Just as an example, but AI doesn't happen without the HI, the human intelligence behind it. And so the thinking is the fuel that's going to drive that technology, no matter what the technology is that we're using. It's only as good as the thinker behind it. So, for example, I'm the driver of the technology. AI is my vehicle, and my thinking is going to be the fuel that runs it.
That's a really powerful analogy. And Don, I actually have a visual that I'd like to put up here for just a moment for everyone to look at, because that picture is worth 1,000 words. And I'm going to ask you to share that one more time, because I think it bears repeating so that we can really start to absorb that analogy that you just shared. So say that one more time, Don, please.
Absolutely. So if I'm the driver and the technology is my vehicle, the thinking is going to be the fuel. And so the vehicle is only going to go as far as the fuel I've put into it. But as the driver, I get to decide where it's going to go, where we're going to stop, what I want to see, where I want to speed up or slow down. But again, without that HI, that human intelligence driving the AI, artificial intelligence, it's not going to be effective. AI is not sitting around thinking about what I want to do. It's going to wait for me to enter some sort of a prompt. And that response is only going to be as good as the thinking that I put behind that. And then even as I'm using it as a tool, I'm revising my thinking. I'm reflecting on the output. I'm considering what might work, what might not work, what's truth, what isn't truth. And so again, the thinker is the driver. And so I hope that helps to kind of make sense of that. And then I see the teacher is more of like the travel guide. Who's kind of pointing out the places that you may want to see, helping guiding you on your trip. You know, if you go the wrong way, you hit a detour, you know, kind of that the teacher can redirect you, get you back on path. But it's also fun to see, you know, as that guide, as that travel agent of learning, letting the student be the driver of that, because they're the ones that are going to bring back the souvenirs of their trip, right? They're going to bring back their snapshots, their keepsakes, those things that they want to remember from that learning. That is where the transfer comes in. How did that journey change them as a thinker? What did it align for them as a thinker? What contradicted their thinking? And then what new ideas have come out of that they can apply in other ways across other disciplines, in their own lives, with friends, with family, with issues that are happening in our world, just determining what their future path might look like. So again, I think it's something we need to embrace and not be afraid of. I think a lot of us are worried that kids are cheating when they're using AI as an example. But really what we're teaching them to do is be more critical thinkers, because now the metacognition, the thinking about thinking, is happening through the whole process, not just at the end of a unit. when we say, oh, what did you learn? What's your new understanding? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, let's speak a little bit more about that, this whole idea of metacognition. I mean, the term metacognition, thinking about your thinking, has been thrown about for decades. And but I'm just curious, in your experience, how do you see metacognition evidenced in the classrooms that you've taught or the classrooms where you've coached teachers and that sort of thing? Where have you seen it happen? How has it worked best? And what types of impact have you seen from, you know, true examples of metacognition occurring?
Sure. I think some of the best examples I've seen is when teachers start with the idea of that gradual release model, and they're demonstrating their thinking and they're processing out loud. You know, I'm wondering about this. Well, why did that happen? Or what do I think the author's trying to tell me here? And just kind of doing that processing out loud so that students are hearing it and internalizing it. And so I've seen it done well when teachers start with that and then let students practice those strategies and apply them in their own work. And then when teachers are able to confer with students and say, okay, well, tell me what you're doing as a reader today, or tell me what you're doing as a mathematician today. Well, how did you decide to start there? You know, what happened when you ran into this problem? Tell me more about what you did here. And so, again, it's that conferring time with students. But then going from that, it's having the students process back. Ah, okay, so at first I thought this, but now I think this. So they really have an opportunity to show how their growth has changed, how their learning has changed. And I think part of that, too, is understanding that learning is a continuum. And there's always something to learn. You know, when you ask students, sometimes they think either I'm smart or I'm not smart. And that's not what it's about. It's about, where are you in that learning continuum? Are you just emerging in your understanding? Are you developing your understanding? Are you really establishing some understanding, or are you extending it? Because no matter what field you're in, there's always going to be somebody else that can mentor you, and then somebody that you can mentor. And so as students, as thinkers and learners, I want them to understand and feel that. And I think that's why metacognition is so important, because there's not a right or wrong answer. It's about the processing.
Yes. So as you're talking about the importance of modeling, the teacher modeling for the students, because it's like any behavior. If we want to see that behavior actualized in the group we're overseeing, whether it's students or even as an administrator, we would like to see that more in our teachers. We'd like to see our teachers be more thoughtful, more critical thinkers. Would you mind speaking to that? Because you've been a building and a district administrator. So talk about the importance of the leaders of the building also modeling metacognitive behavior.
Yes, I think that's so important. You know, as the educational leader, instructional leader, you are the lead learner. And part of that is being vulnerable and recognizing that we can learn from each other. We don't have all the answers. And I've modeled that myself. I tried to teach myself how to play the mandolin over COVID because it's fun size like me. And I didn't have a teacher. I used technology to try to help me figure out how to play this instrument. And so I'm not a master of it at any rate at all, but I played it a song in front of a group of administrators and asked for their feedback. And at first they were very kind and were like, oh, good job, you know, nice work. And I'm like, that's really not feedback. Now give me some honest feedback. Well, you sounded a little out of tune, or you didn't keep the beat, you know, and just sharing that vulnerability with them. And then taking it a step further and say, well, I am a novice, but what I was really working on was, how do I hold the pick correctly? So I wasn't thinking so much about the beat of the song or keeping the tune or hitting the right note. Was I holding the pick correctly? Well, that changes the whole frame of reference, right? And if you're not an expert musician, you may not have the same feedback for me that somebody would who is a skilled player. So I say all that just to model that vulnerability and that point of that we're always learning. And it's important that we share that as administrators, as teachers, that where we've tried something and it worked, where we tried something and it didn't work, what can we take away from that? And that goes all the way back to metacognition again. And so we become a community of thinkers and problem solvers, and it becomes a very safe community to take risks. And I think that's really important in education that, you know, especially when as research develops and we know more, we do better at what we do. It's a practice. And you'll often think about teaching as a practice. Like we give doctors grace because they have a practice, you know, and they spend a lot of time with mentors observing and learning and walking through those examples. And so for teaching and teachers, we need to do the same thing. And as administrators, you are the lead learner and the lead teacher. And so if you are giving that efficacy to your teachers and giving them agency to try things, you're embracing that as a growth, just as we want to embrace our students as they grow.
Yeah. The term you use, vulnerability, it's funny because intuitively, as a former principal myself, I always felt that it was important for me to express my vulnerabilities in front of my staff, that by doing so, it would engender a greater sense of trust and a willingness to follow the lead that I was putting forth, the vision that I was setting forth. So it came kind of naturally, but then I wonder, what is it that prohibits some or inhibits some from demonstrating that vulnerability or having a willingness to fail, to maybe get it wrong and then turn around and make adjustments and move forward until you do get it right? Is there something systemic? Is it societal? What are the factors, in your opinion, that contribute to a less than prevalence of this vulnerable leadership or teaching approach?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with systems, especially when we're in a time where assessment plays such a huge role in how we value teaching and learning, and looking at that one moment in time, that one assessment, so much rides on that. As far as, do we rate our schools A, B, C, or D? Do parents want to move into that neighborhood? What kind of supports do we get? And so I think for me, it's more about those outside pressures for performance instead of looking at learning as a journey and looking at, you know, if a student is spending 1 year in the classroom, we want to see 1 year of growth. They may not be on level at that end of that year, but they may have grown over that year in their abilities and their confidence and their strategies and their skills. And so I think we've placed a heavy emphasis on that one moment in time, that one assessment, and not as much on the pedagogy of teaching. And I think that affects administrators a lot because they have that upward pressure, you know, from up above, results, results, results. And I've always said, good teaching leads to good assessment. And if you're teaching kids how to think and they're learning to think at high levels, if we raise that ceiling for all learners, not just our gifted learners and our high achievers, but raise that ceiling for all learners and then scaffold down with sentence stems, prompts, vocabulary development, images, picture cards, graphic organizers. There's so many ways that we can scaffold, but all students can achieve at those high levels if we raise that ceiling. And again, it goes back to the fact of, I'm not teaching about the apple. At the end of the day, they're going to learn a lot about an apple. They're going to learn a lot about the parts of the apple, how an apple grows, how it gets from the farm to the table. We might even talk about environmental issues affecting, you know, growing apples, organic versus not organic. You know, there's so many layers, as we said. But at the end of the day, is that student able to take the skills and strategies that they learned when we're talking about the apple in the classroom and apply it to something else in their life? It could be, you know, I've learned about the apple, but now let's talk about sharks. Or I learned about the apple, now let's talk about some movements that happened in our history. You know, how were they influenced by structures and systems? And again, it's taking it to that higher level of those big ideas and generalizations and looking at changes over time. So I think if we could somehow build some more agency in our principals and our leaders and give them some self-efficacy to make decisions on their campus to empower their teachers so that teachers feel like they have Some say what happens in their classroom. So I truly believe in a science of teaching and learning, but I also believe in the art and heart of teaching and learning. And we can't give up that for the sake of just going through the motions. This is what research says to do. But then saying, okay, now that I know this, how does this work for my kids? How am I going to engage them? Because what teachers will tell you is they don't have enough time to teach what they're supposed to teach. And kids are more out of control. Their behavior issues are higher than they've ever been. Their attention spans are lower. And they're hooked on technology. Okay, well, I'm not going to say any of those things are not true. But what I am going to say, what are we doing about it as educators to leverage that? Because if kids are not engaged, if they're not finding the work to be meaningful, if it's too hard or too easy, they are not going to want to do it. And as adults, we don't want to do it. We don't want to do repetitive, boring work, or we don't find joy in, you know, doing something that we've mastered. We always want to take it up to the next level, to the next level, to the next level. And so I think that's a part of the system.
Yeah, thank you. And while you're talking about that empowerment of the teaching staff, so the teachers feel more empowered to exercise the art and heart of teaching, as well as the head and science of it. It takes me back to being a fifth grade teacher. And I was doing a book study on Number of the Stars with my students. And during sort of come in from recess or whatever, I always read to the students. I love to read to them and they love to be read to. Didn't matter how old they were, people, it's very relaxing. And I love saying that, using the different voices and dialects and so forth. And one of my all-time favorite books is Bridge to Terabithia. So we were studying Number of the Stars and I was reading Bridge to Terabithia. And I'll never forget it. This young man in my classroom made the connection between the two main characters in both books and said, really, the relationships that they enjoy are so similar. And then he went on to explain what made those relationships so similar. So these totally dissimilar books in my mind up to that point became so much more similar. The themes were more similar, the relationships more similar, and so forth. So I stopped everything I was doing and created a whole study. And the kids were like, yes, yes, yes. Wait for you to study comparative literature study around Bridge to Terabithia, Number of the Stars. And so to me, I guess what I love is that came from the students. So just as the administrators need to empower the teachers to ownership, the same thing with the students in the classroom. And so I had to veer off of my lesson plans and my unit. So what? Because now they were learning at a much deeper level. There's so much more joy in learning. And I was having greater joy as the teacher as well.
Yes. You're speaking to my heart. That was my very first grade level I ever taught was fifth. And Number of the Stars was one of the books we did. And Bridge to Terabithia is one of my all-time favorites. But you bring up a really, really good point. And if I could add to that, I think where we're seeing some of that joy being lost also in the classroom is that we give students a passage to read. It's isolated. It's not part of a rich, in-depth novel. So we give them this isolated passage and we say, okay, answer these questions at the end. And remember to use text evidence. And I call that kind of a game show approach. You know, here we are. If you get the questions right, you get the A. Even if there is an analytical question in there, the teacher is still looking for a right answer. And we've not really taught the students any strategies. And one of my favorite things I've held on to from my training years ago with thinking maps and right from the beginning was, I think it was Jane Buckner said, Ches the glitz. We used to say Ches the glitz when we meant elaboration, because that's what kids hear. And so when you're giving them a passage and they're just answering questions, it's like Ches the glitz. You're not teaching them how to think. You haven't taught them that, you know, when an author is crafting a passage, whether it's informational or narrative, there's a structure to it. And for example, in a narrative, and this is what your student did, they had an aha moment. Well, characters have aha moments, and that's a really big signal that something is about to change in the plot. Or they may read something and it's a real contradiction to what they read before. You know, contrasts and contradictions are a signal. that something is changing. There's a difference happening, whether it's narrative or informative. Characters ask big questions. You know, there's all of these strategies we can teach students that will empower them as readers. So whether they're reading Number of the Stars, The Hunger Games, The Giver, or whatever, you know, book they want to read, they own those strategies. But if we're just doing a passage with questions and saying, use text evidence, all that does is reflect what was in that passage. But it doesn't empower me as a learner and as a thinker to take something away from that reading. So we're teaching maybe the reading, but not the reader. So I love that example you gave, because you were teaching your readers. You know, they had that aha moment, and you leveraged that to go even deeper. And I would be willing to bet that you covered your standards anyway.
Yeah, and I have to say to the principal, I'll give her a shout out, Tony Mamula, at the time in Fort Bend ISD. I don't think I could have done that if I didn't have an incredibly supportive principal. If anything, encouraged that type of behavior in the classroom. Certainly didn't discourage it. Well, you referenced the training that you had in the past and the work of David Hartley and the work that grew out of David Hartley's work. And most recently, you attended our very first webinar centered around NeuroPoints. And I was just going to ask you to speak to our listening and or viewing audience a little bit about your impressions and your thoughts, if you will, around this new thing called NeuroPoints.
Well, as soon as I saw David Hartley's name, and then I saw Kevin's name next to it, it immediately said to me, this is important. I need to see what's developed and what's new. So I was on board immediately because I truly believe in the work that David has done in the area of cognitive processing and thinking about visual learning and making the learning visible through coding and creating, you know, visuals that help us to connect to our brain's natural processes. So I was already hooked before I got there. But then once it started, I found myself leaning closer and closer in because I wanted to soak all of it up. I had my colored markers there by chance, and I was color coding and following along during the webinar to learn more and more about NeuroPoints. And what I discovered, and I'll be honest with you, I haven't stopped thinking about it since that webinar. It really felt to me like it was the missing link for differentiation in the classroom, for really giving teachers the empowerment to provide an entry point into some very in-depth thinking, some rigorous, complex thinking with complex texts and complex concepts, but doing it in a way that was easy, flexible, ready in a moment, but really giving teachers that power to say, okay, it's not about the apple, but what is it about? You know, thinking about all the different approaches. And I know in the research, there's five main ways that our brain processes information. And so the NeuroPoints, to me, that was the key, because now we're not just reaching out there and saying, well, I wonder what that strategy is. No, we know what the strategy is. We know how the brain processes. So now let's leverage that and help teach students how to code their own thinking and processing so that they, like I said earlier, they're the driver of the vehicle of whatever it is that they're trying to learn about. And to me, you know, instantly I thought of GPS. I was like, okay, well, NeuroPoints is like that GPS, you know, tool that we use to get around. Because I remember when phones weren't smart and cars were even dumber, and I had a terrible sense of direction. And I drove for 2 hours one time because I was afraid to wake up my friend and tell her I wasn't sure where we were going. So what I think NeuroPoints does is it helps you see where you're going, but even on the journey, you can take some detours so that you can understand things at a deeper level by looking at them from the different points of inquiry, you know, the five different points.
I love that. So this whole idea of points of inquiry, elaborate a little bit more on that, because you shared that with me last week, and I was fascinated with how that really frames the thinking that's going to grow out at that point of inquiry. So tell our audience a little bit more about that as well.
Sure, absolutely. So I wanted to practice this with some content that I wasn't as familiar with because, you know, Thank you, David. But I'm a little bit from Missouri. I wanted to prove it to myself that it would work. And so I chose 11th grade, I think it was 11th grade U.S. history, and thinking about the civil rights movement and looking at some leaders that influenced that movement. And so there's a standard, there's a TEEK standard, there's a learning objective, you know, compare and contrast, you know, two of the major leaders of the civil rights movement. And so I started with that and I thought, okay, if I were doing this and using NeuroPoints and I really wanted my students to own this, where would I start? Like, what would be the entry point? And for me, it went back to the idea of character points. And I said, okay, let's look at character points. So when we're thinking about character points, we're thinking about traits, qualities, values, comparing and contrasting. And I thought, okay, let's look at Martin Luther King and let's look at Malcolm X. Very different leaders, very different traits and qualities, some similarities, but why were their approaches to the civil rights movement different? So to me, that was kind of my entry point. So I might say something like, you know, how do our experiences and our traits as a leader influence the decisions that we make? Now, that's an open-ended question I could apply to anything, but now I'm going to apply it to the civil rights movement. So how did the viewpoints, traits, and experiences of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X impact the civil rights movement? So now I'm taking them into the content. Okay, so once they're in the content now, well, I have to do a lot of thinking, right? I have to think about, well, who is Martin Luther King? Who is Malcolm X? What did they stand for? What was their background and experiences? What was their message and their way to communicate that message? So there's a lot of thinking on that side of it. Then I could go deeper and say, okay, what did Martin Luther King have to say? Let me look at one of his speeches. Let me look at one of the speeches of Malcolm X. Now their speeches have a structure. Now I'm looking at part points, right? And I'm breaking the structure down. What was their opening? What was their argument? What was their call to action? So now I can look at those more specifically. Then we can talk about other perspectives, viewpoints. Who agreed with them? Who disagreed? How did their influence impact the actions of other people? And how did that create the movement that we saw in the civil rights movement? Because two people by themselves couldn't do it. So you have that first follower and that second follower and then that group and those brave people that made decisions. And then how did it change over time? You know, after this so-called movement occurred, came out of that. You know, what are we still seeing today? So we've got some change points we can talk about. So I just thought it was really interesting that you could take that topic, look at it from those five different neuro points, basically. And I created a real quick visual map without doing any research yet. I was able to visually see as a teacher where the kids might go with this. Then I can introduce AI as a tool. Then I can teach them how to use AI. When are they the co-pilot? When are they the pilot? How much of the AI is influencing what they have to say? And giving them permission to be that critical thinker. Is there bias in what I'm seeing in AI? You know, whose voice isn't heard when you get that response? And then you can recraft and redefine your prompts. And that's, again, that metacognitive level over top. Because as a learner, I could say, well, I started with character points. But as I was investigating and learning more, I realized I needed to use part points to look at their speeches. And then once I really understood their message, I went to change points to see what was happening during that time or just after that speech was made. You know, so it continues that discussion. But at the end of my unit, not only are they going to learn about the civil rights movement and they're going to learn about the leaders that influenced it, they're going to learn about the major events and the outcomes of that. But now they own those strategies. They own that big idea and those generalizations. That what I started with was, you know, how do our traits, our values, and experiences as leaders impact our decisions? Now students are ready to take that to the next level. What's happening in our world today? What's happening in an organization I belong to where leaders are making decisions? What's happening in my school? Do I agree with what's happening or do I disagree? How can I make an impact in my community? You know, so there's so many different directions you could go with it. And, you know, like I said, character points doesn't have to be the entry point. That was just where I naturally started. I could have chosen any of the five mirror points as my entry point. But the inquiry point, I guess where I'm trying to go with that is, what is the question that's going to drive the thinking? That's where I come up with that inquiry point. What's that essential question? Basically, it's always been, you know, we've always called them essential questions, but what is that essential question that's going to hook that student in?
Well, what stands out in what you shared is the integration of thought. So while your entry point may have been character points and focusing on those values and characteristics and so forth, you very quickly started moving to the part points and so forth. And so I love the integration, and I'd like to kind of layer on to what you just shared. When you put all those pieces together in an integrated visual, that in essence, you've created a neurocode. And that neurocode, as you said, is that intermediary step between the thinking that I do and the feeding of this input into an AI engine to produce a given output.
Exactly. So I think that goes back to what we talked about earlier about the thinking being the fuel that's driving the journey, basically driving the vehicle, whatever it may be. I think, again, why I can't let this idea go of mirror points, why I'm so excited is because visually I can see my thinking. I can very quickly map it on a scratch piece of paper to get myself started. I've got the colors that represent like viewpoints, might be blue sky thinking. You know, I think of possibilities and perspectives, you know, where change points is green because we're growing ideas. You know, I kind of think of it in that way. And so, you know, and I think that's the brilliance too of what David's created is he's not only attached, you know, those points of interest, those inquiry points, but then also the color coding, the simple links, and the little nodes. You know, the first time I saw one of the neural points maps, I thought, oh, that looks like a neuron in the brain. You know, I thought that's exactly what our brain is doing, because we don't think of things linearly. I can't even say the word, in a linear fashion. Thank you. We don't think of things in that linear fashion. We're processing it from all those angles at the same time, which can be overwhelming as a learner when you're trying to process. So seeing it visually with the mirror points, I think, is very powerful. Having the color coding is very powerful. And then figuring out, you know, how can we leverage that tool as an AI tool and put that power in the hands of students so that they can see, oh, wow, I'm really doing a lot of thinking from viewpoints, but I haven't done, you know, as much from group points. I need to focus on that maybe a little bit. Or maybe this is an area I'm really strong at because I can really, I can sense how things can be sorted and categorized. So maybe that's an easy in for me, but maybe I haven't looked at viewpoints enough to think about other people's perspectives. So I think it's very valuable from that metacognitive standpoint. And just really leveraging technology. Let the technology work for us, you know, because again, we're the HI behind the AI.
Well, you mentioned something about looking at it from different viewpoints, and a word we didn't use here, but you were basically alluding to, is empathy as well. Yes?
For sure. Definitely empathy. I think that goes back to, you know, when you think about whose voice is missing, whose voice are we hearing? Because no matter what text we're reading, there is bias in that text. And so whether a neat piece of art or, you know, looking through the lens of history or even in mathematics, you know, we're looking at things from different perspectives. There's more than one way to get to that particular solution. And so if we don't embrace that, we may miss an opportunity to grow from somebody else's ideas. Or again, like you said, to have empathy and understanding that they may see it in a different way, you know, where I don't see, I'm not very good mathematically with numbers, so my spatial awareness is also not very good. But I have a better understanding of language and writing. And, you know, for me, that's easy. Whereas, you know, for my husband, he's very mathematically minded. He's very mechanically minded. So he thinks it in a different way. So it really helps me have an opportunity to grow as a learner and as a thinker when I can process things from other points of view. And then beyond that, realizing that my view is not the only view, but the loud view doesn't necessarily mean it's the right view. If that makes sense. So we do need to teach our students to be mindful that just because you hear something loudly and frequently doesn't necessarily mean that that's right or true. And so being that careful consumer of information through social media and, you know, how quickly we get information now.
Well, Dawn, we are a little beyond our 30 minutes. I tried to keep them to about 30 minutes, but this was such a rich conversation. I had to keep us going. I tend to round things out, though, with a, is there anything else about which you're just thinking that I did not give you the opportunity to address in this episode? And no doubt we're going to have more of these conversations, Dawn. But, so what's something that's kind of burning in your mind right now that you're just thinking about that we didn't get a chance to address?
Well, we did address a lot. So I'm trying to process, you know, everything that we talked about so far. I think at the end of the day, I want teachers and students and administrators to remember the joy in the learning process. You know, the more we enjoy something, the more we're going to learn. If we can laugh, if we can smile, if it feels good, we're going to learn it and it's going to stick for a lot longer because we are feeling beings that think. And so what I have found just in the short time I've been exposed to NeuroPoints, I've been thinking about thinking for a lot of years. And what I have found is it's bringing me some joy to realize that there are tools being developed. There's more research that's coming out that shows us how we can bring that joy back to learners, how we can empower teachers to go from wonder to wisdom. And so that's, I hope, the message that they'll take away is that this is not one more thing. I think it's the thing that ties it all together, to be honest. I think it's going to make sense when teachers embrace it just from the simplicity of how it's used. But we've talked about simplexity. You know, it's complex thinking, but it's a simple approach. And so I hope that they'll see that and realize that they can keep the art and the heart and the science of teaching all together.
Teachers are going to love that. So, Dawn, thank you so much for your gift of time, for your gift of thoughts, and for your gift of wisdom and your years in the field and just and your willingness to share all that you've learned and gathered throughout your career. And I want to thank you for the gift of your friendship. So thank you for being part of Just Thinking today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'll be seeing you around.
Bye.